On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's day two of our holiday special featuring writers and artists from this year's New Yorker Festival. This hour, we bring you conversations on life, humor, and a bit of Sex and the City style. The Daily Show's Jon Stewart holds court with New Yorker editor David Remnick. Cartoonist Roz Chast shares her sources of creative inspiration with actor, comedian, and author Steve Martin. And top shoe designer Manolo Blahnik answers the question, why shoes? This hour, On Point conversations from the 7th Annual New Yorker Festival. In 2000, staff writer Michael Spector profiled Manolo Blahnik for his New Yorker article, High Heel Heaven. Blahnik grew up on a banana plantation in the Canary Islands. In 1971, he was an aspiring set designer until then-Vogue editor Diana Vreeland pushed him to design shoes. He's since become a cultural icon of high-heeled style. Here, Michael Spector asks Manolo Blahnik to explain one of his latest design inspirations.
You told me recently you were making ridiculously expensive shoes out of titanium now?
I did, but it was not a very successful one.
Because?
I did one which is like a retake of one of my 1976 shoes with no heel. You know, like sort of...
Who could forget?
Yes. It comes from, I saw again a woman called Celia Cruz, which is the greatest singer in Latin America, Cuban. And she used to walk differently. And when I was a child, it was all black and white movies. And she had those kind of shoes. And I thought, oh, how can you do that? And then I find out you can do it aluminum, you can do that. And it's a wonderful, comfortable shoe, this one.
And in titanium?
In titanium. I did it this year. It was so expensive, you know, titanium and then crocodile and then things. So it was impossible to produce.
Yeah, I totally gave up buying titanium
anyway,
shoes for that reason. Why are you so obsessed? You seem as interested in movies as you are in shoes. Are they related?
You know something? I'm telling you, movies and shoes is just my two obsessions, so I don't think it's one less, because I love movies, yes.
What have
especially
you...
Marie Antoinette, I told you again, push it again, because I never seen a movie so exquisitely, you cannot go wrong. Everything is done in Versailles or in places like 18th century, beautiful places that the Queen used to go. So it's like, apart that, it's visually the most important movie made in the last whatever.
Yes. Shut up.
Beautiful, yes, yes, yes. Not because I did a stupid shoes, no. I didn't do that because it's beautiful look and it's with another fresh look. And I never see Marie Antoinette young. I always see Marie Antoinette, Norma Shearer. I saw Marie Antoinette, Michel Morgan. Millions of Marie Antoinette, you know.
Now
but
we have
that
young
one was young, beautiful, and the period that the film covers is exquisite. I didn't know that. This kind of careless thing about...
Can you just... Okay, come back now. Can you quickly go through, like, how do you work?
Nonstop. And I love it. And as I get older, even more and more.
And
I don't
know
why. I don't know. Maybe it's because I think it's like the thing I like the best is to do things, you know.
But do you...
You know something I was thinking the other day? I wanted to be a stonemason.
You want to be a stonemason?
Yes, yes. I think it's the most rewarding. I did it two summers ago. Two summers ago, I just cut the stone and do it. And
I did it, yes.
And I was thinking, maybe I'm losing my time doing shoes. I should do something else, maybe.
But you don't.
But I didn't do it. No, I didn't do it. I didn't follow
it.
What
is exciting when you see a woman wearing your shoes? Does that thrill you?
Always is. It's always like a kick when I see somebody wearing the shoes. And if the woman knows how to walk. Because with my shoes, you have to sort of interpret the walk-in, you know?
What do you mean, knows how to walk?
You put it on, those shoes, and you have to interpret it. And you become what you want to be with those shoes. And some people don't really get it, but most of them do.
Do you sit around your... you've had the same place in London for basically 30 years. You don't seem to be a person who is as...
71, yes. Many years.
35. You don't seem to be as aggressive about expanding. I know that people have offered to spend many, many millions of dollars to absorb you into their companies. That doesn't interest you at all?
Money's not my nature. No, no, I don't like it that much. This huge conglomerate thing. No, because it's not because you. It's because I don't like it. I like to be there. I like to control everything. I like to, if something is wrong, I want to be responsible. If something is wrong, I know. And in this conglomerate, you get lost.
And you want to actually make the shoes. It's not enough to draw the shoes?
I do the sample, yes. I do the sample.
How long does it take from drawing a shoe to people wearing them?
It's a very long process. It's something like, let's say, collections right now, for instance. I'm doing already winter 70, whatever. 2007. So it'll be about a year, yes.
Now, there is always a tension in the world between artistic things and things that sell. You don't seem to care as much about selling, though you obviously do. But are your favorite shoes of yours the ones that sell the best?
Some. Yeah. Some. But mostly the ones I adore, they're a bit too elaborate or maybe too difficult to cut or whatever it is, and it's so expensive and maybe it's not a very commercial thing. But
would that be an example of that?
That is not mine. This is mine, yes, but it's done for Dior. The wonderful John Galliano, the wonderful Maasai collection in 90 whatever, I don't have a clue for dates, but and it's beautiful, that shoe. It's wonderful because he's saying on the telephone to me, think about Africa. So I went to this gallery, I was in Venice in winter, like sort of December or something. It was snow, Venice was empty. And I found a small gallery that sells artifacts, African artifacts. They say, do you have beads? I need beads. So the men say, well, maybe. And they look in the back, and they have incredible color. I took the beads. I did it in a muslin, which is called muslin, cotton. I cut it and got it and glued it with Yoohoo, which Yoohoo is in England, is some kind of glue. And then I send it to John, and he said, oh, that's my shoe, okay. And we started to work that way. I love to work with John because it's incredible.
Are you still working with... No.
No, because it's like I haven't got time, and he's got this incredible sort of huge, teams and things. No, that's I work couture. I did Couture Dior and Galliano for years, years, and years. And it was a wonderful experience. I loved it.
Sometimes women tend to grumble about wearing high heels and say they're uncomfortable and they're obsession by men who don't give a about women. And
men don't give a about women
no.
wearing high heels?
I'm not
They
talking
love
about,
it.
But what about, what do you do when women complain about the shoes?
Complain about the shoes? But I haven't got many complaints about the shoes, and I see a lot, especially in those kind of things. I feel like sort of, when I go to those things, I don't know, we went the other day in, where it was? In San Francisco. We had this incredible line of people, so sweet people, coming to buy the shoes, and I signed them or whatever I do. And then I felt like, almost like a Jesuit priest touching the people and say, something. I was so embarrassed, actually. I was so embarrassed. I feel it's very unnatural to me, all this kind of thing, you know. But you know, somehow, I have not, in this contact with people, I have not one who say to me, oh, your shoes have killed me, or whatever. No, they don't. No, no. Is this what you want to say? Sometimes I just follow
just,
my...
Just say what okay. you want. I'll stop you if I have to. What happens at those little signings? What do they say to you? What do these women say to you?
Oof. That is very complicated, because I have even women coming to me with a little baby, which is 2 weeks old, very tiny. I never see such a thing. It was like a little rat, a little small like this, and you know something, and red, and thing. And he had wonderful little pumps. And the women say, "Mr. Blandy, this sounds like too much, but would you like to sign those little shoes?" I said, "It's going to be. Is he a girl or a boy?" They said, "No, no, he's a girl." Okay, well, I sign it because maybe she's going to be one of my future customers.
And if it was a boy, you wouldn't have.
I don't like little boys. No. No, I don't.
Thank God I have a daughter.
Thank God. I hate children. In fact, I don't like children very much.
Okay.
Sorry.
You know, you actually just drove the thought out of my mind. But do you think about the future customer? I mean, when you say you hate children, you like teenage girls?
Well, I like to think about future customers, yes. Uh-huh. In fact, I have the future customers because I have those kids of 17 to 20-something. To me, they're kids. So I think it all the time about them.
Why don't you make men's shoes?
God, it's so boring to do men's shoes. As I say before, what can you do? Oxfords, sling bags, or maybe you can go into the wonderful sort of type of shoes that everybody wears now, those, you know, gymnastic shoes and walking shoes that I don't like.
You mean sneakers?
I saw one here. Sneakers. That's, I was trying to find the word. Sneakers.
Yeah, the gymnastic shoes are big these days. What's your idea of happiness for you?
Goodness, that's weird.
What, you're the only person?
You know, I don't even know what happiness means, but I guess it's like a sort of group of circumstances and things and attitudes and things that make you happy, but I don't know what happiness means. Happiness means harmony, maybe. I would be very happy if the world would be a little bit happy. I mean, be a little bit more harmonious right now.
The world. Do you ever, you're someone who follows the news quite closely.
Unfortunately, yes.
Do you ever think, you know, there's Al-Qaeda, there's bird flu, there's wars, there's politics, and I'm making shoes.
You did a wonderful...
It wasn't an advertisement for me.
No, but you did a wonderful thing about the flu. Yeah. And it worries me tremendously, yes. And sometimes I feel, what the hell I'm doing here? What the hell I'm doing this stupid, frivolous work? When all this seriousness... But, you know, sometimes I make myself sort of... convince myself that, yeah, after all, I make people happy for 2 seconds or maybe 2 afternoons or maybe 1 month or maybe 1 year wearing those things and, you know, seeing yourself pretty or whatever. If I do that, I mean, as I repeat all the time, it's okay.
Celebrated shoe designer Manolo Blahnik talking with New Yorker writer Michael Spector. In this holiday edition of On Point, we're listening to conversations from the 2006 New Yorker Festival. Comedian and satirist Jon Stewart is best known as the host of Comedy Central's The Daily Show, the immensely popular program with a cutting critique of politics and news. Here he talks with New Yorker editor David Remnick about the show and media culture.
It's always interesting to me because we traffic in government and Hollywood for the most part, and the similarities between the two cultures are so stunning that it's hard to imagine that they're ever at odds with each other. And maybe it's a, you know, they used to say that politics is show business for ugly people. But I believe that show business is politics for the powerless. Because it is, the people in Hollywood believe themselves to be the center of, they conduct themselves with an air of importance and a sense of power. But really it's because you get to sit near Tom Hanks at the premiere. Like you really, right. What you do actually is, kind of doesn't matter.
Now, am I right that no one in the Bush administration will go on? Do you guys make
an effort?
I don't
know if you're right that they won't go on, but they haven't. But that, I don't think that they, I don't think it's a willful act.
But you make an effort.
Yeah, we make an effort. But we usually get them after they leave and they write the book, and then they come on and go like, yeah, those guys. You know, and you're like, yeah, you were there. And they're like, yeah, but I'm not, you know. So that's when they sell them out, so.
So every president who you want after they're out of office, every defense secretary, they'll all come on. And what are they
That's
selling?
Right.
They're selling
William Cohen. They're selling. Well, they're salesmen to begin with. They're all politicians, so they are. You know, the sense that I get typically from the politicians is similar again to the people that I get from Hollywood, which right. is, when's your movie opening? Uh-huh. Tell me about the product. Very nice. It's all salesmanship, and they believe, rightfully or wrongfully, that we have. An audience that is a demographic, that is somehow elusive.
And they see it as what? Young, coastal?
I'm not in their meeting, but I'm sure they see it as this thing that is elusive, the elusive 18 to 34-year-old male that typically is only playing video games and therefore can't be touched by product placement, you know, or mm-hmm. something. So they come on to tap into that, you know, reservoir of gold that exists out there.
Are they right about the demographic? Do you have any idea?
I don't know who watches this. They don't. See, here's the thing about the TV show, and I should really explain this. You can see me, but I can't see you. So I don't know who's, you know, people always say, who's watching your show? And I go, I you know. As far as I'm concerned, the only one watching my show is three big cameras, you know. So I just don't know. I mean, anecdotally, I would say it's people who live in my neighborhood. Because they're the ones that typically will go, hey, man, I saw your show last night. And I'll go, oh, okay.
You had Bill Clinton on recently.
Yeah.
And what was he selling?
He was selling his new fragrance, you know.
Musk.
The man's always selling. He's a salesman. He's a guy that is, you know, even... What's so interesting about him is that even... Most of the time, you know, when we had Bob Dole on, and we had Senator Dole on for a long time, he had been out of politics at that point. And you see the persona shift. You see dramatically the facade that had been held up for years as an electoral presence is now gone. And you see the talented or interesting person that, before they were corrupted, existed and why they got into it in the first place. And it's impressive. And while Clinton is extremely impressive, you still see the salesmanship and you still...
How so? What were the signs of it?
Well, for instance, when you're talking to him, you feel that he really likes you. And my guess is he doesn't care about me. But after I was done talking to him, I thought, yeah, we will hang out. I mean, he is... The amazing thing about Bill Clinton is, no matter how tall you are, when he talks to you, he is your height. It's like E.T. You remember E.T., how his head would just change? If he was talking to a child, he was 2 feet tall, and then he was 6 feet tall. Like, he is... You know, and as far... You know, my mother met him. And as far as my mother is concerned, he had never met someone's mother before. And it was an amazing experience
for
Bill Clinton.
Yes.
And that's his genius. And you would think at a certain point after politics that he could maybe show you that you're bothering him. But he doesn't.
Are you a fan of any politician? Do you have a sort of special...
Yeah, I'm a big Lincoln guy. I just thought what he did was great.
Anybody alive?
Not so much.
Not so much? Not so much you can't afford
anybody
this?
that's impressive
yeah.
to me. First of all, let me say this. You know, people think that we are cynics. And I don't want anybody to confuse cynicism with skepticism. And I think actually that we're generally the opposite of cynics. We are desperate babies, you know, crying to be held.
We being all of us or we being...
We at the show.
Right.
In fact, I employ only babies.
What do you expect will happen out of it? Part of what you are you're a press critic, and probably the most astute press critic there is.
Yes,
and
I am the most astute press critic there is.
And for example, you did a thing about.
But here's my
the
point.
Rubrics under CNN.
But
every one of them
this.
Have. A, okay,
here's my point. I'm an astute press critic who interviews Pervez Musharraf and has a real effect on politics. But the truth is, what do I do that is different and unique that makes people watch? And that is, I make page sodomy jokes. And if I stop doing that, I'm no longer anything.
Right.
And that's the thing to remember is, unless it's filtered through that prism, we are, if anything, editorial cartoonists. And it's just another press. You know who has a lot in common with us? Fox News. And I don't mean that in
because
the sense
think...
of, I'm not trying to denigrate them by placing
sure
them
are.
In our boat. I'm not. But they are reactive. And I actually think that news would be better off being reactive than being what it is now, which is rudderless protoplasm.
Where do you get your news? What's your sort
By
of...
By the way, if this stops making sense at any point, please let
I'll,
me know.
I'll pick up the glass. Where do you get your news? How do you get it? And what do you find reliable and what do you think
on the
nonsense?
Tickers on the top of cabs.
Is that enough?
So it's only sports scores, and it's usually a few hours behind.
Yeah.
I get it like everybody else. You know, you consume it in the morning through papers and then websites, and I leave the 24-hour news networks on in my office all the time because I don't want my day to be bereft of sadness, so I want to make sure that I have that on so I can watch it.
But are you more bereft about or angry with or skeptical about, say, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the networks than you were years ago?
No, I think print is, for the most part, I think print does a pretty remarkable job. It's just that, you know, I'm sure back in the old days, the town crier was quite, you know, did a nice job. But print is, in this day and age, it's not obsolete, but it is certainly not. People don't wait for the thud of the paper on their doorstep in the way that they used to. And so the in-depth and oftentimes really insightful, long articles that you find in print don't, I think, have the same thing when you have... The way we look at it is basically this. In the media atmosphere, you bring either clarity or noise. And for the most part, the people that have overtaken the business have the biggest noisemakers.
Is CNN clarity or noise?
Noise.
All of it?
I don't even think they know. Honestly, I don't, with all due respect.
How do you compare them and Fox? What are they?
I think Fox knows what they're doing and CNN doesn't. So that would be my comparison.
CNN doesn't know what it's doing in what sense?
They don't know why they exist. They know they're in Atlanta. But they have no, there's no editorial point of view. There's no perspective on it. They're literally just throwing shit up there and hoping that, I mean, you know.
But you think they should be outwardly liberal or outwardly one point of view?
I don't believe in political designations of liberal or conservative. I believe in you can be outwardly right or outwardly wrong. But I don't know what that has to do with liberal or conservative. And that's, we're trapped in this weird, like, as though that the only two forms of thought can be liberal or conservative because, you know, how could it be more than two? But I think that, you know, CNN clearly just whatever they think might work. You know, Anderson Cooper is a talented guy, but, you know, you can't just stick him in Africa and think that saves your network, you know? It's here's why I think you have to be reactive.
I'm not sure we know what that means in this context.
Oh,
reactive.
Okay. Reactive means that you are actively, Fox News is actively pursuing something. They are actively pursuing what they feel is an editorial slant in the other media that they need to correct. So they believe that they are a corrective, you know, a salve to whatever they thought is festering in the media culture. They're wrong, but because what they think is wrong isn't really what's wrong, I don't think. We are reactive in the same way, except we just think that what's wrong is that most of it is theater and very little is authentic. So the reason that you have to be reactive is government and corporations work nonstop, incessantly, 24 hours a day to create noise. And if you're just reporting, in the old term of I just report the news, there is no such thing. What you're reporting is the smoke from the machines
so
that they have set up in front of their...
So what you're saying, there's too much he said, she said, he said. Somebody has to basically puncture the bullshit and say this is what's true and this is what isn't in a much more assertive and clear
way.
Why
would you ever put on advocates for various groups knowing that they're not coming on to bring a debate of any clarity? They're coming on with a media strategy.
Joe, one of the events that we had for the festival was a screening of a new movie starring Robin Williams called Man of the Year, in which a figure not unlike you suddenly becomes popular not only as in the form that you are, but suddenly starts to run for president and wins.
Wow.
I can tell
That's
you...
That's quite a premise.
Yeah. And I've seen around town T-shirts that say Stuart Colbert in 08...
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
What do you think about all that stuff?
I think it's a real sign of how sad people are. All this stuff it says to me is people will look to anything to try and show a sign to the people in charge to bring them shame. Nothing says, I'm ashamed of you, my government, more than Stuart Colbert 08. I don't know how else to put it. You know, people always say that, you know, is that realistic? Do you think that could happen? No, that's people going, we're not being served. People put up our show as a news show because they feel underserved by news shows. It says nothing about our show's news ability or news content, because we aren't that. We're not journalists. Mm-hmm. We have one guy with a TiVo. And he tapes shows, and we go over it and go, oh, shit, did you see that? We're cranky people like that would sit in a bar and yell at the TV, only somebody gave us a show.
Right.
But the reason that people keep presenting us in that manner is because they feel sad about what they're being served with.
You think that, would the show be as funny with a better administration? Would you have as good a time? Would it be as popular if things were a little less disastrous, if there wasn't everything that's going on?
Are you saying, do I wish for the destruction of our nation?
That's pretty much it.
I honestly don't know. If you're saying that with a different administration, you know, not give us anything to work with, you know, I have a lot of confidence that the next administration, and there will be one,
yeah,
will somehow find a way to be
authentic. Bush is especially cooperative, isn't he? I mean, even
he's especially disciplined. They're especially good at creating a reality. He is the most amazing thing about President Bush is he has convinced everybody that he's stupid. And that's, you know, the big critic. He's just not bright enough to be president. He's just not.
You don't buy
that. Please. Stupid is, oh, my God, I just ate soap. Like, he's not. The guy's, he went to Yale and Harvard.
Yeah.
And he's convinced us that he's this Texas podunk that really doesn't know what he's doing. It's one of the more shrewd things. Because listen to how he speaks. He speaks like this. If you ask him a question, very complicated about something, he will do the way you describe something to a child. What about Dennis Hastert and the Foley Page scandal? And what the president does is he just describes all the facts about describing Dennis Hastert that he knows. Dennis Hastert's a congressman. Known him for 10 years. He's a coach. He's a father. Mammal, has epidermis, he has a skin. Covered. His wife breeds live, no eggs. Next question. You know. And what you realize when you listen to him speak is he talks as though he's talking to someone stupid. And then it all.
You think he's condescending to his audience in a deliberate way. When he says, I decide, I'm a decider, that kind of rhythm, what is that?
What could any other explanation be? What do you, you know, Mr. President, what are you going to be doing? You know, the Iraq policy is a complete disaster. I make decisions. It's the president's job. I'm a decision maker. you know, he might as well just say, so run along. I mean, the president, the overwhelming, I think, overriding operative principle of this administration is stop bothering us. That's the way it seems to me, and the most overriding operating mentality of that administration is competitiveness. And they would like to crush whoever it is that is bothering them, whether it be Democrats or terrorists or... And everything is a means to an end. But the problem is Americans will put up with a great deal of shitty means if you're bringing us to a decent end.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, nobody can see the ends because we're not so... You know, freedom is overrated when it comes to not having electricity or water. Ask the people in New Orleans, you know, if they want more liberty or, you know, potable water. You know, this whole idea that somehow freedom, you know, you can spread whatever you want, democracy, freedom, Nutella, whatever you want to spread, if people don't feel safe.
Joe, how would you describe your politics? When you were describing yourself as a kid, you said that I was really into Eugene Debs and I was kind of a lefty. Would you pretty much the same now or...
Did I really say
not.
That?
Yeah, you did. It's
how
in
annoying
Wikipedia.
Would that be to be a kid? Have a 12-year-old kid going, yeah, I'm kind of a Eugene Debs guy. Really? I'm sure that's like anything. Like when you're a kid, you're like, you're into Metallica. You know what I mean? You're into the most extreme thing you can think of because, you know, that's what you want it to be. I'm into leadership. I'm into people doing things that I think they're doing for the right reasons. I'm into the idea that let your argument win the day.
Jon Stewart, host of Comedy Central's The Daily Show, talking with New Yorker editor David Remnick at the 2006 New Yorker Festival. To conclude, we bring you Steve Martin and New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. A native of the Flatbush section of Brooklyn, Chast published her first drawing for the New Yorker magazine in 1978 when she was 23. Her quirky, neurotic interpretations of family and home life have won over many fans, including comedian and actor Steve Martin. Here, Roz Chast talks with Martin about life as a cartoonist, what makes her laugh, and about how she began drawing funny pictures as a young girl.
Well, I like to draw pictures that made me laugh from the time I was really, really little.
And like age what? Four or five.
I always loved to draw, and I liked to laugh, and I liked to draw pictures that made me laugh. What was I talking about?
So you're sort of doodling. You're talking about you used to like to draw a.
I drew little weird comic strips when I was a kid.
Horses.
That was a lot of trouble when I was a kid because at a certain age, little girls are supposed to really love horses and really love to draw horses. And I used to get this magazine called Highlights for Children. And they had something in it called Our Own Page, which I was fixated on. And all the little girls, it seemed, you know, they would have like, you know, Bonnie Sue Bickens, you know, age 9. And then she'd have this drawing of a horse that was just incredible. And, I mean, with the veins and the mane and, you know, prancing and, you know, and A, I didn't like horses. I didn't like to draw horses. I lived in Brooklyn. I didn't really see a lot of horses. And, you know, but I felt like if I ever want to be taken seriously by Highlights, I'm going to have to get into this horse thing. And because it did seem like most of the girls, that was their thing. And so there was one time where I decided, okay, this is it. I'm going to fill up this whole sketchbook with horses. And I tried to draw them very, very seriously. See, I was about 10 years old, and I named them. There was like Brighty and Blackie and Whitey and, you know, Prancy. And it was very, very serious. And then I remember looking, I finished finally, and I looked at these horses, and I laughed and laughed because they were so terrible. But they were kind of funny. I mean, they were smiling. They, you know, their heads didn't really go on their body. Like, I didn't understand, you know, then the back leg had this bend in it. The whole thing was very confusing. But I thought these horses, they don't look like real horses, but there's something about them that's really funny. And
so you saw yourself heading toward comedy.
Yeah, now, definitely. Whether I wanted to or not,
we're gonna
I didn't.
Skip ahead because I want to know about the state of first, some of the people you liked as cartoonists. You're in your early 20s or late teens. You're looking at a few cartoonists. And talk a little bit about the state of cartooning at that moment.
It was a very strange thing when I started out. There was underground cartoons, which were definitely an influence. But I didn't feel like I really fit so much in with that. And there were magazines, but it wasn't really the golden age of cartooning as I understand it. I mean, at one point, there were lots and lots of markets for cartoonists. When I got into the field in 78, there was pretty much Playboy and The New Yorker as far as if you wanted to make your living being a magazine cartoonist. And I never really thought I was going to wind up doing cartoons for The New Yorker because at that point, most of the cartoons there... there were exceptions, but most of them were what I think of as kind of genre cartoons. They were, you know, gag line cartoons, things where, you know, two guys would be sitting in a bar and maybe saying funny things to each other, or an office situation, or a boardroom, or a pie chart, or, you know, just these various, a desert island. And the things that I found funny didn't really have any place there, I didn't think.
And you were saying earlier that they had often the cartoonist was separate from the writer.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that had started to change by the 60s, but okay. For many, many years, from the beginning until pretty much through the 60s, there was one person who did the drawings, and then there were these people who were gag writers, and the artists would often buy gags from people. And when I first started, I would get these packets, and they were really funny. They weren't that funny, actually. But there were things like, you know, two guys sitting in a bar. And I'd say, well, wait a minute. Does this person even have any idea what I do? Because, you know, I was doing the little boxes, but that was what...
Okay, now you've packed together some cartoons.
Right.
And how do you get them to the New Yorker? What do you do?
Well, when I started in 78, I called the New Yorker and I found out they had something called a drop-off day. And that's where you take all your cartoons and you drop them off and sort of wait to see what happens. So I got together. I had no idea how many to put in. I just, at that point, I'd been doing some illustration work, which wasn't going very well because I wasn't really that interested in it, and doing a lot of cartoons myself. So I packed up about 60 cartoons and put them in this one of those brown envelopes that, you know, you buy at a stationery store with a rubber band thing around it with a little hole in the... And,
I think we got the picture.
You got the picture, yeah. I like those things.
Are there things you really like to draw? I mean, objects that appeal to you?
Yes. I love to draw interiors.
Mm-hmm. Many of your cartoons are interiors.
Yes. Now. I love lamps.
Lamps?
Lamps are good.
And what was the source? I know you grew up in Brooklyn.
Yes.
And do these interiors reflect where you grew up?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I spend a lot of time indoors studying these things, mm-hmm. lamps. And I think they're kind of funny looking.
You know, I found, if I could talk about myself for 1 second, that if you make a movie or do something, you get an immediate reaction. And then there's another reaction 5 years later, and then there's another reaction 10 or 15 years later, whether it's like it might have been a big hit, and then it's 5 years later, nobody mentions it stinks, and 15 years later, it's great or it's horrible. Do you have that with cartoons, like a resonance that continues on?
I think cartoons are more ephemeral, maybe mm-hmm. because they, you know, the New Yorker comes out every week, and so there's always a sort of new image. Mm-hmm. It's very...
But I find your cartoons really just living in my memory, which we're going to get to later. The one I'm sure everybody here has a favorite. And that's what was a favorite film. Anyway, now this gets us to something about the inanimate object. Talk about... You seem to love to draw these weird things or these very mundane things.
Well, my mother had a phrase that she used when I was growing up. She called it the conspiracy of the inanimate. I don't know if she got it from somebody else, but it was sort of how these things kind of have a little bit of a life of their own.
Let's go to the next cartoon while you're talking about that.
Okay.
Let's make it work.
Why
don't you read this first?
Okay.
Yeah.
This is Get Well Cards for Under the Weather Appliances. And this is Get Well Soon for a TV set. Contrast's gone, picture shot, don't know what it is you've got, you'll soon be fixed, but even so, we miss your cheerful little glow. this is a hair dryer. Cold blows warm, hot blows cold, fact is, friend, you're getting old. Hope you repair it soon. And this is to a sick dryer. You burned a shirt, you charred the socks, you gave the folks electric shocks. A leaky hose, a missing screw. We hope that's all that's wrong with you.
Very cute.
All right.
I'm curious. Do you ever take outside ideas from people, or do people try to give you ideas?
Yeah. Dentists and. Uh-huh. it's kind of fun. I'm not really good at taking people's.
And at first, did you see you just? They usually are off the mark somehow.
Yeah, they're kind of off the mark. It's kind of like, you know, when you collect something sometimes, mm-hmm. and then somebody decides they're going to add an object to your collection, and they found the perfect thing, and it's really not.
Yeah,
it's kind of
like,
oh, this is great. Thanks.
Yeah. Do you collect? Speaking of collecting things, do you get inspiration from magazines? From do you tear out things?
Yeah.
Do you make mental snapshots?
I do. I mean, there's magazines are great. I mean, for a while, I got a magazine that I loved. It was called Snack Food, and
yeah.
it was for the snack food industry, and it was just amazing. I mean, it had articles on. Like there was this new term that I learned for chips called mouth clearance, and it had to do with like how big the chip was, like when you put it in your mouth, kind of like a car going into a garage or something.
I heard a scientific term which I actually like a lot. It's called bug flux.
Bug flux.
And the
what
bug
is it?
Flux is where the bugs from the land meet the bugs from the sea. And it may be 5 or 10 miles in.
Great.
It's called the bug flux. Anyway, let's move on to the...
enough
about me.
Do they fight?
I don't know what they do.
It's like...
why don't we move on to the next cartoon? Okay. Now, we're talking about these objects again.
This cartoon, this is the gifts from the House of Low Goals. There's T-shirts. I survived conjunctivitis. I can read a bus schedule. 100% human DNA. Special occasion cakes. Wow, only 6 cavities. Happy tattoo removal. And no loitering arrests in 1 year. Cards. I'm so glad you're not an arsonist. And congratulations on your new easy chair. And trophies. Participant. And
that's hilarious. Now, what is the next one? I know we're getting to some actual photos. 60.
Okay. This is this cartoon is the 60-hour gourmet, I can read it. Even though it's, like, very wordy. This is recipes for people who have time to spare and then some.
By the way, this is what I'm talking about, the writing aspect of this. This would be funny without the cartoons.
Yes, but pictures are fun.
I understand.
Okay. This is painstaking peas. Before cooking, peel 600 peas. Boil, then arrange in a festive manner on a serving platter. This is never-ending bread. Mix bread dough as usual. Let rise until double. Punch down. Let rise again. Punch down. Let rise. Punch down. Let rise. Punch down. Rise. Punch. Rise. Punch. Rise. Punch. Rise. Bake and serve. This is slow and steady chicken. Wash chicken in a lukewarm bubble bath for about 1 hour. Then rinse for 30 minutes. Stuff with difficult stuffing, that's see page 883, using a doll spoon and truss with an itsy-bitsy needle and the teensy-weensiest stitch you can. Cook at 125 degrees for 32 hours, and just prior to serving, carve into the shape of a rose. the last one is handmade carrot juice. Begin by mincing raw carrots with a butter knife. Then keep going until the whole thing reaches a liquid consistency.
I get the feeling, although it cannot be true, that you're just walking around laughing all the time. You're finding, I mean, you could look at that corner and find something amusing about it.
It's laughing or crying.
Yes,
one or the other, yes.
Kids. You have kids.
Yes.
And I think you get a lot of inspiration from them.
Yes.
Should I? Yes, please do. Okay.
This was sort of a kid's thing. I don't know if you have kids, but they're always telling you to look. You know, Mom, look. Look. And this is, tooth is hanging by a thread. soda can is bulging. black and blue mark is completely gone. Parakeet has particularly cute expression on his face. Someone who looks like gym teacher on TV. Cut on toe opened up again. and learned how to make smoke come out of the computer. And the mom is saying, that can't be good for it, can it?
You've done a lot of work for Scientific American and the Sciences magazine. Yes. Science is an interest of yours, obviously.
It's an interest. I have a kind of love-hate thing going with it.
Do you stay up with, you know, the science page of the New York Times?
Yeah. That pretty much covers it.
Right. So let's take a look at some of your cartoons. This one was in Scientific American.
This one was actually in the Sciences, mm-hmm. and it's the kid who learned about math on the street. If you divide 6.973 by zero, you die. Once this guy tried to find the square root of -9, and his eyeballs turned black. This girl my brother knows found out exactly what pi equals. She went nuts.
And our next scientifically related cartoon.
This is BioLab. These were just some weird things that
Coming soon from BioLab.
Coming soon from BioLab, a jalapeno pepper that's 50 billion times as hot as a regular jalapeno.
No, we got plenty of time. Okay. We're fine.
Okay. Things like the all-meat chicken. It's 100% meat through and through. There's no bones. There's no beak. There's no feet. No skin. No icky parts. No waste. It's just solid chicken. Alcobroc, one of nature's most nutritious vegetables with an alcohol content of 35%.
Very good. Well, Roz, this has been a great morning. It was just to see all your work is astounding. And the continued creativity, and as I say, I'm so impressed with just the writing ability and the drawing ability and the way these cartoons are rendered in such a humorous way. And you've really made your own great body of work, as so did Van Gogh.
And
so thank you very much, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cartoonist Roz Chass talking with comedian and actor Steve Martin this fall at the 7th Annual New Yorker Festival. More information on this year's festival and guests is available at our website, onpointradio.org. Our thanks to the writers and staff of the New Yorker magazine for their partnership in bringing you this broadcast. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.